with a magical press of the button. And I'll hand it over to Nick McGarren.
Thank you. Thank you, Craig. And welcome to everyone. It's lovely to see some of our students from Northumbria and members of the public. I'd like to thank you as well, Alex. You mentioned Jeremy Corbyn in the armistice without making reference to a comment from the Daily Mail, which said Jeremy Corbyn was dressed like a scruffy, like a geography teacher. Now, I personally thought that was a great compliment, but maybe I was misreading the comment that was made. So the question which was posed is, what sort of foreign policy does the UK need today? And the answer I'd like to give is this. It needs a foreign policy with a good memory. We need a foreign policy with a good memory, because how we remember the past is crucial to how we make foreign policy in the future. And I want to think about three ways in which we can make a better foreign policy in the future by thinking about how we remember the past. And the first is to remember that commemoration is always geopolitical, and so we need to think critically about it. The deaths in certain places are worth grieving, according to the media, and in some places they're not worth grieving. And what stories about the drivers of geopolitics does commemoration tell? So, for example, in 2003 there was a horrible shooting of Serb teenagers in Kosovo. And it was declared by the Serbian government as a day of national mourning. Now, of course, this was to address a very real human need to grieve and mourn. And all the critiques that Alex and I will make about commemoration are in no way to deny the human need to mourn. But declaring this a day of national mourning was also a geopolitical move. Serbia was trying to increase pressure on the United Nations not to keep Kosovo in its fold, not to allow Kosovo to become independent. And by showing that Kosovo was an unstable terrorist state, it hoped that it could slow down the move for Kosovan independence. If the boys had died through substance abuse or through a house fire caused by a dropped cigarette or a suicide pact, you wouldn't have had a day of national mourning. It would have still been as tragic for the families, but it wouldn't have been geopolitical. So commemoration is always geopolitical. Exactly 3 years ago today, the Islamic State militants killed 43 people in Baghdad, 18 in Beirut, and 120 in Paris. Yet international media focused far more on the events in Paris. Pray for Paris was a meme that travelled. Facebook allowed people to drench their user profile in the red and white and blue of the French tricolour, not in the colours of the Iraqi or Lebanese flags. The Indian poet Karuna Parikh wrote this poem. She said, "It's not Paris we should pray for, it's the world." And she went on to talk about the difference in which was the attention that was given to Paris as opposed to the rest of the world. And she concluded her poem by saying, "So pray for Paris by all means, but pray more for the world, for a world that is falling apart in all its corners, not simply for the towers and cafes we find so familiar." And so on to World War I commemoration. How does commemoration explain the events of World War I? Point Alex was making. World War I was seen in Germany as a defence of Christian European civilization against the barbarous French and the megalomaniac Imperial Brits. It was seen in Britain as a defence of freedom against, well, the barbarous and megalomaniac Germans. So geopolitically, I want to suggest that instead, a way to think of First World War is as a clash of imperial powers. As Alex said, at the early 20th century, you had the Americans in the 19th century, they'd been expanding across the Pacific, like in the Philippines in 1898. Russians were moving down into Central Asia, into Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, the most important countries in the world. The British and French had carved up much of Africa. And Italians were starting to do the same. So if you see the First World War as a clash of imperialisms, then the narrative of commemoration looks different. So, for example, the Department for Communities and Local Government, as part of the World War I commemorations, sponsored the laying of commemorative paving stones to provide a, quote, a lasting legacy of heroes and honour their bravery. And that the aim of the government was to unveil a paving stone at the birthplace of each recipient of the Victoria Cross in the First World War. This is an image of the unveiling of a stone. This is a plaque next to the stone in Witton Park in County Durham, marking the birthplace of Roland Bradford. And those of you who know your World War I history will know that the Bradford brothers were the only brothers to be awarded a Victoria Cross in that war. Now, there's something I found objectionable about this. It's objectionable for three main reasons, describing this as heroes. The department website said, no hero will be forgotten. What's objectionable is that veterans don't talk about themselves as heroes. So think of recent years where people have been given the VC in the Iraq or Afghanistan conflicts, and interviews with them in the media, and a journalist will say, you're a hero. And they'll say, I'm not a hero. I was doing my duty. I was looking after my mates in the regiment. Secondly, this depicts the war as a heroic struggle rather than a murky geopolitical rivalry, a clash of imperialisms. And thirdly, it's objectionable because most commemorations are alphabetical. So this is the war memorial here in Newcastle University, which is then Armstrong College. And it's worth looking at. And it's like most commemorations for World War I, it lists names of the fallen alphabetically. Ranks are not given, nor are honours. Indeed, even those people who are shot for cowardice or desertion, the opposite of heroism, are included in these commemorations without comment. What the government's policy here of putting these commemorative paving stones for heroes is doing, it's tearing up a century of practice. Well, why is that? Well, Alex has already indicated a clue. In 2012, David Cameron made an announcement at the Imperial War Museum of £50 million to fund World War I commemorations. He said he wanted a commemoration, quote, that captures our national spirit in every corner of the country, that like the Diamond Jubilee this year, celebrations this year, says something about who we are as a people. So clearly this was not simply about the past, it was about national identity, remilitarising Britain. And these heroic ideas about our armed forces battling, heroically battling for good against evil, against baddies, informed Cameron's own foreign policy. So in 2011 we had the intervention in Libya. A very problematic and difficult one. Clearly Gaddafi was a terrible tyrant. Britain intervened, overthrew the tyrant. But what followed it? A power vacuum in which Islamic State emerged there. Islamists emerged there where they'd not been before. Where the country was carved up between Islamists, criminal gangs and warlords, which spread violent Islamism down into neighbouring states, which allowed criminals to take control of migrant movements, facilitating the so-called migrant crisis a few years later. It was disastrous. In 2013, as Alex has indicated, he went to Parliament to try to get permission to intervene in Syria on the side of the Islamists against the president at that time. The talk from Cabinet was, we have to stand with America like we've done in the First and Second World Wars and against tyranny. Peter Hitchens, a Conservative commentator writing in the Mail, described Cameron as a vainglorious fantasist. He said this, the moral bomber is one of the scourges of our age. He gets it into his head that he is good and he's allowed to kill people in a noble cause. And I think if we had overthrown Assad at that time, Islamic State emerged a few months later, it would have been even more awful than Islamic State was if they had controlled the whole mechanisms of a state. So this type of approach to First World War and to modern geopolitics is about reading global geopolitics through simplistic stories of good and evil. It confuses the complicated geographies and histories on the ground with this simple story with disastrous results. So it does matter how we remember, and the first thing we need to do to make a good foreign policy in the future is to think critically about how we remember the past. But the second thing we need to do is we need to remember different histories. This is a statue. Has anyone seen this statue? It's a wonderful statue. It was unveiled by Andrew Young, who was Martin Luther King's lieutenant, if you like, in the civil rights movement. Unveiled last autumn to celebrate 50 years since Martin Luther King came to get an honorary degree. It's worth going and seeing this. And what we did in Newcastle, we commemorated King's visit, not just as a great civil rights leader, but as someone who stood against militarism. He condemned all war, and as someone who stood against poverty. And one of the things that a group of activists did in this city, academics, Craig was involved, Alex was involved, we produced this teaching pack for schools to commemorate Martin Luther King as a non-violent opponent of war. So one of the things we can do to memorise, to remember well, is to remember these peace histories. A second thing we've been doing in Newcastle is to remember the Christmas truces, to remember moments in the First World War that... Tony's holding up a... Tony...
Christmas tree, Christmas cards.
Yes, you can buy Christmas cards with the Christmas tree, with Christmas tree's pictures on from Tony at the end. Thank you, Tony. The Christmas truces were something that we in the peace movement here in Newcastle and in the universities sought to focus on, sought to remember. This is a picture taken by R. Robson of the Northumberland Hussars in December 1914. And I want to read a brief extract that appeared in the Newcastle Daily Journal. This was from a soldier in Gateshead writing home in December 1914. He wrote home in January 1915. He said this. He said, on Christmas Eve, the Germans lit up their trenches and started calling across, Merry Christmas. We responded in the same vein. And then we started singing carols to one another. By this time, all shooting had stopped. We walked about the parapets of the trenches and called out to one another. Then some of our chaps walked out and met some of the Germans halfway, wished each other a Merry Christmas, shook hands and said they wouldn't fight today. We had communion service this Christmas morning on a farm about half a mile away. I don't suppose I shall ever go to such another Christian service. It was so reverent and the surroundings were so rough. When we came back, we decided to go along the top. They would be in full view of the enemy. We got back safely and then some of our chaps started kicking a football about outside the trenches. Then the Germans showed themselves, and to cut a long story short, it finished with us meeting halfway, shaking hands, and exchanging fags and souvenirs, and parting the best of friends. One has given me his address to write to him after the war. They were quite a decent lot of fellows. I can tell you, I know this seems an unbelievable story, but it is a fact. I'm sure if it were left to the men, there would be no war. And one of the things we can do to make a better foreign policy in the future is to remember this sort of thing, not as an isolated romantic event, but as something much bigger. 100,000 men took part in this. But it was part of a system, the so-called live and let live system, that went on through the whole war, where people on opposite parts of trenches wouldn't shoot each other. There were whole sections of the front line where no one was killed for years and years in the First World War, because they agreed. They start off by saying, well, we won't shoot each other. They're only maybe 50 yards apart. So we're going to have dinner now, let's stop shooting. We're going to bath town now, let's stop shooting. And this would develop to whole systems where people wouldn't shoot each other. And no one was killed for years and years. It's part, we were celebrating the truces as part of this history of resistance to the ideology of war and a glimpse of not only of a rejection of the industrialised warfare of the war, but a glimpse of what a different Europe and a different humanity could have looked like. And if any of you are teachers or pastors or go to churches or have kids in schools, we produce these resources, again with local activists, to help mark the Christmas truces. Do take information about that. The second thing we did to here in Newcastle to remember, the third thing we did to remember history, to think more peacefully about history, was the commemoration of the Peace Society. One academic has described the peace movement as a successful British export. Now, ideas about peace have existed through history, but it was only in 1815 and 1816, with the founding of the peace societies in New York and London, that the idea of a peace movement, like Stop the War, emerged. People who were committed through meetings and minutes and campaigning to change the policy of their government. And in 1816, it was one formed in London. And Newcastle had a very active auxiliary. In 1837, a report of this auxiliary the Newcastle Auxiliary said this. It said, in 1817, a few persons met together in this town, Newcastle, and united themselves as an auxiliary to the London Society. The aim of the society is to establish the position that war is inconsistent with Christianity and the true interests of mankind. And in 2016, a group of us, including Daniel Lacroix, and some of our students here from history in Northumbria, you know Daniel, he's a great historian of the at the peace movement in Northumbria, we had a conference to celebrate and mark the peace, the Peace Society's founding, and we had a big peace fair at Northumbria University where we invited all the local peace movements, and we had Kate Hudson from CND giving a talk, and we laid a commemorative wreath of white poppies outside the war memorial. Because Britain's very good at celebrating battles and wars. What we need to be doing is celebrating peace history, celebrating these movements, celebrating these moments. Alex mentioned the nuclear, Trump's nuclear policy. Maybe we should celebrate the signing of treaties. It's 30 years ago that the Nuclear Forces Treaty was signed, and partly in pressure by the British peace movement to limit nuclear force, nuclear weapons. Trump's tearing that up. Maybe we should be celebrating the establishment, the signing of treaties. And the final thing I suggest we do is apologise. This is how we can make a good foreign policy in the future. Thinking about the past and apologising for it. Ours has been called the Age of Apology. Well, the late 1980s, early 1990s. This was Ronald Reagan signing an apology, an act, to the internment of Japanese Americans in the Second World War, which came with compensation. And now, it's easy to criticise apologies for past events, but these are meaningful. Japanese Americans welcome this as a recognition, not that racism had gone in America, everything was fine, but a recognition that they've been mistreated. Kathleen Noble, she's visited a few times. She led something I was involved in called the Reconciliation Walk, where groups of Christians walked the length of the First Crusade apologising for it. It's a really crazy thing. I haven't got time to talk about it now, but we walked through Europe, Middle East, and finished in Jerusalem saying sorry. This is someone saying of our group, saying sorry to a random Turkey met in Ankara. Sorry for the First Crusade. I haven't got time to talk about that now. It's really creative. But I think we, as UK foreign policy, we've got a lot of things we could apologise for, and a way to make a better foreign policy is start doing some apologising. For example, the example I can think of is the treatment of the Chagossians who lived on the Chagos Archipelago in the so-called British Indian Ocean territories. As Mauritius was heading for independence, we carved off this territory, and in 1971 we forcibly evicted the population, a couple of thousand people. Their animals were their pet dogs were gassed, and they were evicted and dumped in Mauritius and the Seychelles to make way for a US air base that is still there today. And this is a protest outside the High Court. These are a couple of thousand people who are British citizens. A good way to start building a better foreign policy would be to say sorry to them, to allow them to return. They could even live alongside the US air base. It's on a different island. And we could make recompense. So a way to make foreign policy better is to start saying sorry for some things in the past, remembering things we've done wrong and putting them right. So to finish, the question was, what sort of foreign policy do we want today? And I suggest the foreign policy that we need is a policy with a good memory. A good memory. Firstly, the UK is very good at remembering battles and wars. We should be much better at remembering peace history, moments of peace history, and using that as an opportunity to teach young people. Secondly, we should not whitewash the past, but remember things the UK has done wrong and apologise for them and put them right. And finally, we should think critically about how we remember the past, how we do commemoration, how we do Armistice Day. And I want to finish with a poem from someone whom Alex, as an English teacher, mentioned, Siegfried Sassoon. This is the Menin Gate in Belgium that was built after the First World War to commemorate the 54,395 British and Commonwealth soldiers whose bodies were never found or identified. And Sassoon, who served in the war, wrote a very famous poem about this. Who will remember, passing through this gate, the unheroic dead who fed the guns? Who shall absolve the foulness of their fate, those doomed, conscripted, unvictorious ones? Crudely renewed, the salient holds its own. Paid are its dim defenders by this pomp. Paid with a pile of peace-complacent stone, the armies who endured that sullen swamp. Here was the world's worst wound, and here with pride, their name liveth forever, the gateway claims. Was ever an immolation so belied as these intolerably nameless names? Well might the dead who struggled in that slime rise and deride this sepulchre of crime.
Two great presentations, lots to think about, and unlike when I give presentations, also moments of hope, also lots more moments of clarity as well. So we have